On Easter Sunday, April 14th, 1816, the cane fields of Barbados were burning, and the man history chose to remember was not the one who told the people why they had to burn. That distinction matters. It has mattered for 210 years, and it has been buried beneath layer after layer of colonial record-keeping, engineered to give credit for black resistance to the figures the empire could most easily contain. Warriors, martyrs, names that fit a legible story of sacrifice. What those records do not accommodate comfortably is a woman who could read, a woman who understood that power lives not in the torch, but in the idea that the torch is justified. A woman who looked at a newspaper and recognized before anyone else in that plantation yard the weapon hidden inside it. Her name was Nanny Grigg. She was enslaved at Simmons Plantation in the parish of St. Philip. If you have not heard of her until this moment, understand that this is not an oversight. It is a design. The archive was built to forget her. The island of Barbados in 1816 was a colony under pressure. It could not fully calculate. The British Parliament had spent years debating colonial reform, and the Registry Bill, legislation requiring planters to formally document every enslaved person on their property, a measure intended to curtail the illegal trade in human beings, had sent tremors through the planter class. The planters read the bill correctly, not as a bureaucratic inconvenience, but as the leading edge of emancipation. The debates in Westminster were serious, and they were moving in one direction. What the planters failed to calculate was that the people they enslaved were also following those debates. Specifically, Nanny Grigg was following those debates. She could read. In a society where literacy among the enslaved was not merely discouraged but actively criminalized in all but practice, where a newspaper held by the wrong hands was understood by the planter class as a genuine threat to the social order, Nanny Grigg possessed a skill that transformed her information into organized power. She was not the only literate enslaved person in Barbados, but she was one of the few who understood what her literacy was for. In the weeks before Easter, Nanny Grigg was doing something that would later appear, uncomfortably specific, in the colonial trial records that followed the rebellion. She was talking. She was gathering people, and she was explaining to them what the newspapers said and what it meant for their lives. The testimony preserved in those trial records, recorded by a court that did not intend to honor the people it was prosecuting, describes Nanny Grigg addressing groups at Simmons Plantation and telling them in substance this: freedom had already been granted by the Parliament in England. The planters of Barbados were concealing it. They were holding what was already legally owed. The people would have to fight for what was already theirs. This was not a rumor. It was a political argument, and it was a sophisticated one. Whether the legal situation in Westminster in early 1816 had actually reached the point Nanny Grigg described is a matter for historians to parse. What is not debatable is the logic she had identified, that the planter class controlled the enslaved population partly through information monopoly, and that breaking that monopoly, putting the newspapers in people's hands, translating the language of empire into the language of survival, was itself an act of resistance. She had identified the architecture of colonial control, and she was dismantling one wall of it, brick by brick, in the weeks before April 14th. This is where Nanny Grigg disappears from the popular story. Not because her role is undocumented, because it is documented in ways the archive did not design to honor. Bussa led the rebellion. That is established, and that is real. He was described in records as a ranger on Bailey's plantation, effectively a head slave, a position that gave him unusual mobility across the plantation landscape and the ability to maintain contact with enslaved people across multiple properties. He organized the military coordination. He commanded in the field on Easter Sunday. He died in battle that day, cut down before the uprising was suppressed by militia and eventually British troops. He was a man of courage, who paid with his life and who deserves every dimension of the recognition Barbados has given him. His statue stands at a major intersection in Bridgetown. Arms raised, face forward, the posture of someone who refused the position assigned to him. But wars do not begin with their generals. They begin with the belief that the war is possible, necessary, just. That belief does not emerge from nothing. It is constructed, argued, shared, and felt before it is ever acted upon. The military operation on Easter Sunday, 1816, had a political infrastructure beneath it that the colonial record tried very hard to flatten into background noise. Nanny Grig was that infrastructure. The trial records from the aftermath of the rebellion include her in ways the court could not entirely avoid. Too many witnesses named her. The testimony was too consistent to dismiss. The court's response was to frame what she had done in language calibrated to minimize it. Inflammatory talk, dangerous rumors, a woman spreading agitation, the language of threat management, rather than the language of political organization. But read those same records against the grain. Read them as documents produced by frightened people trying to contain something they had not anticipated. And what emerges is a portrait of a woman who had been thinking carefully about freedom for a long time before she said a word about it. Publicly, she survived. That fact, too, has been underweighted in the historical memory. Busa died. Many of the enslaved people who participated in the rebellion were executed in the aftermath. Trials moved quickly in a colony that needed to reestablish the terror that kept people compliant. The estimates of those killed in the fighting, executed after trial, or transported off the island run into the hundreds. Nanny Grig was tried. She was sentenced. The historical record is frustratingly inconsistent about the specific terms of her sentence, which itself tells you something about how carefully her case was managed. She was not executed. The court, in whatever calculation it made, did not make her a martyr. Whether this was prudence on the part of the colonial authorities, a recognition that executing the woman who had argued for freedom on intellectual grounds would only amplify her influence, or whether it reflected a certain contempt, the dismissal of her role as mere talk from a woman rather than leadership from a commander, is something the archive does not clarify. Both explanations say something damning about the system that made the decision. The 210th anniversary of Busa's rebellion falls this April. In Barbados, scholars and cultural organizations have spent years working to restore Nanny Grig to her proper position in the story, reading the colonial trial records, not as the planters designed them to be read, but against their architecture, hearing the voice the court was trying to reduce to a footnote. Those records are held in archives, accessible to researchers. The testimony is there. Multiple witnesses, under oath in a colonial court, named a woman at Simmons Plantation who told enslaved people to read the newspapers and then told them what the newspapers meant. That happened. The documentation of it survived because the court needed it to construct its prosecution and could not sanitize it entirely without making the record absurd. What the 210 years of relative silence around Nanny Grig's role reveals is not a failure of historical methodology. Historians who work in the archives know she was there. The silence is a failure of transmission, the gap between what the archive contains and what the popular story carries forward. Popular history is not neutral. It makes choices about which names become statues and which names remain in the footnotes. Those choices reflect the values of the people making them, and those values have historically included a strong preference for stories in which men lead and women support. Nanny Grig did not support. She preceded. She established the intellectual conditions under which the military action became thinkable and then executable. She created the political consciousness that made thousands of people decide, in the weeks before Easter, 1816, that what was being done to them was not simply their condition, but a crime being actively maintained against them. That distinction between condition and crime, between fate and policy, is the difference between endurance and resistance. Nanny Grig made that argument. She made it to the people around her, in a plantation yard, with a newspaper in her hands, weeks before anyone lit anything on fire. There is a version of Caribbean history in which Nanny Grig is a central figure, in which the 1816 rebellion is understood not only as a military event, but as a political one, one that required both the courage to fight and the clarity to understand what the fight was for. That version exists in the trial records. It exists in the scholarship of historians who have spent careers in the archives, doing the careful work of reading colonial documents against themselves. It exists in the memory of St. Philip Parish, where Simmons Plantation stood, and where the woman who read the newspaper lived and organized and survived. The question is whether the public story, the story told by statues and national holidays, and the popular history that shapes how a people understand themselves, is willing to hold that complexity, whether there is room in the national memory for the woman who told the rebellion what it was about before the first torch was raised. The cane fields burned because someone understood that freedom deferred by concealment is freedom that must be seized. Bussa understood how to seize it. Nanny Grig understood why it was theirs to take. 210 years later, that woman's name is still in the record, still waiting. Whether history is large enough to hold her alongside him, that is a question only the people who inherit this story can answer.